From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You're hearing live-streamed video posted on YouTube of the Syrian government's bombardment of civilians in Homs, state policy that a United Nations panel this week said amounts to a crime against humanity. Citizen journalists like this 26-year-old live streamer, Rami Al-Sayed, often have been the only ones positioned to expose what's happening in Syria. Now he's dead, killed Tuesday in the streets of Homs. Once there were wars in which journalists were considered, if not honest brokers, then parties to be courted, when waggish American Middle East reporters could wear T-shirts exhorting in Arabic, "Don't shoot, press," and assume, at the very least, it would not make them more of a target. But that was decades ago.
Now you're hearing the Skyped conversation on Wednesday between two Syrian activists, one at a makeshift press center in the Bab Amr district of Homs. Marie Colvin is there, a legendary American journalist reporting for the UK's Sunday Times. Marie Colvin was 56. Through the miracle of Skype, you just heard her die. Also there was Remy Ochlik, 28, a prize-winning French photographer. He died as well.
But the baby's death was just heartbreaking, possibly because it was so quiet.
One of the Marie Colvin on what may have been her last broadcast with CNN's Anderson Cooper. She was in a makeshift clinic, an apartment, actually, with plasma bags hanging from coat hangers.
And then the doctor said, "There's nothing we could do," and we just watched this little boy, his little tummy heaving and heaving as he tried to breathe. It was horrific. My heart broke.
In a private message to a colleague on Facebook, she wrote, "Sickening. Cannot understand how the world can stand by, and I should be hardened by now." She added, "We'll keep trying to get out the information." This is the sound of a tribute to the killed journalists this week in the streets of Homs.
Generally, we at On the Media are resistant to what we've come to call journalist in peril stories. After all, like soldiers or firefighters, journalists choose to put themselves in danger. But obviously, Colvin and her tribe are there for those who didn't choose, whose deaths during the 11-month Syrian uprising passed 5,400 in January, which is when the United Nations stopped counting because they couldn't verify the numbers. As this tribute demonstrates, the citizens of Homs understand the sacrifice of those who choose, whether salaried with a computer, freelance with a camera, or amateur with a cell phone. In this interconnected world, they are united against a common enemy, silence.
Jean-Pierre Perrin, a journalist for the Paris-based Liberation newspaper, who was with Colvin in Homs last week, said they'd been told the Syrian government intended to shell the media center. He said the Syrian army issued orders to, quote, kill any journalist that set foot on Syrian soil. Rupert Murdoch, who as owner of the Sunday Times was Marie Colvin's ultimate boss, described her as, quote, one of the most outstanding foreign correspondents of her generation, with a determination that the misdeeds of tyrants and the suffering of the victims did not go unreported.
Funny story. The New York Times' Brian Stelter reported that Marie Colvin feared that her accounts of indiscriminate bombing by the Syrian government were not able to reach the widest possible audience because of the Sunday Times' paywall. Days before her death, she asked a fellow journalist to post her article where non-subscribers could read it. "You have my permission to post it," she said, "and I will take the firing squad in the morning." She apparently knew that she would bring down the wrath of her bosses. Stelter reported that on Wednesday, the day of her death, it seemed to be the only article by or about Marie Colvin that could be read by non-subscribers, and that includes her obituary.
The Iranian state is currently silencing one of its leading lights in cinema. Director Jafar Panahi was hit with a 6-year jail sentence for what the Islamic Republic has called propaganda against the state. What's more, the 51-year-old Panahi is banned from making films for the next 20 years. He's not in jail yet, but while he waits in legal limbo, he's made what he calls an effort. It's a film titled This Is Not a Film. Photographed in his apartment on a digital camera and an iPhone, This Is Not a Film chronicles one day in the director's life, a day in which he tries to reenact the screenplay the government has barred him from filming. At one point, he gets down on his hands and knees in his den, using masking tape to create a blueprint of his unmade movie heroine's bedroom so that he can act out a scene.
I'll start from here. And these lines that I draw, they're the walls of the girl's room.
Panahi performs a read of the scene for his friend holding the camera.
What is it? Why don't you continue?
In a moment. We hear the end of the phone call. Maryam thinks for a moment, although she's upset. If we could tell a film, then why make a film?
Panahi's This Is Not a Film has been smuggled out of Iran on a USB drive baked inside a cake. U.S. audiences will get a chance to see it in theaters this week. Panahi, obviously, isn't able to speak with us, but Jamshid Akrami can. He's a professor at William Patterson University in Wayne, New Jersey, who studied censorship in Iranian film. Jamshid, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob.
We hear his lawyer tell him that he's most likely to go to jail for some portion of his 6-year term, and that perhaps they will scale back the 20-year ban on filmmaking, but not eradicate it altogether. And his response as a resister is to essentially poke his finger in the eye of the government. Is he in more danger as a result of this? Or has he kind of inoculated himself against further repression?
The government is basically not happy about the fact that he made this movie quite illegally. But I like your use of the word inoculated. Yeah, maybe he is, because he's so well known across the world right now, and his plight has been so well publicized that the government is really afraid of him. They're afraid to send him back to jail.
Even had he been permitted to shoot his film, the restrictions for filmmakers in Iran are onerous, to say the least. Give me an idea of what an Iranian filmmaker is up against.
Making a movie in Iran is really something close to a miracle, given all the draconian censorship codes. Any sort of physical contacts between men and women is banned in Iran. Forget about any sort of romantic stories, contact between a father and a daughter, or a mother to embrace her son. You can't have scenes of that nature either. Also, another example would be how it's the Iranian Islamic law that women have to cover their hair. But in their homes, women, they don't cover their hair. But when it comes to the Iranian movie, they still have to cover their hair in the privacy of their homes. And if you noticed in this movie, his wife and daughter are all outside of the house. And that's a rather curious choice, because if this is a day in the life of a filmmaker, you would want to see his family. He doesn't show them at home, because if they were to be home, they had to appear with exposed hair, and that would not have been possible. So he's trying to avoid committing a lie, a fabrication, basically. The fact that Panahi keeps his wife, daughter, and mother out of the film in itself is an act of protest against the women's conditions in Iran.
Panahi is something of a genius of playing the hand that is dealt him. You mentioned that his wife and daughter don't appear in the film. We learn that they are out delivering New Year's gifts to his mother. The filming does take place during New Year's. And outside, there are these enormous fireworks displays.
The day happens to be what we call Charshanbe Suri, which has been roughly translated as Fireworks Wednesday. This is a tradition that has been frowned upon and actually dismissed by the Islamic regime, but embraced by the majority of Iranians as a day of rage and resistance against the regime. Panahi has chosen this particular day to celebrate the people's defiance of the regime.
So Panahi shot this film, pressing all of the buttons that he was certain would most infuriate the regime. What's happened since the film escaped from Iran?
Panahi has been basically kept in limbo by the Islamic government. They're not sending him back to jail at this time, fearing the repeat of the international outcry that his initial imprisonment caused a couple of years ago. But at the same time, they have kept him from working as a filmmaker. He's preoccupied nowadays, as I'm sure a lot of other Iranians are, with the chances of Asghar Farhadi's...
The director whose film is up for Best Foreign Film in the
Oscar. Yes, A Separation, winning an Oscar or maybe even two. But he's deeply frustrated that he cannot make his own movies. You know, this is a situation that the Islamic government should be really ashamed of, to be putting one of their best filmmakers in the prime of his career in such an unpleasant situation and try to completely silence his creativity.
Jamshid, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Bob.
Iranian documentarian and scholar Jamshid Akhrami teaches at William Patterson University. His forthcoming documentary about censorship in Iranian film is called Cinema of Discontent. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and healthcare. On the web at rwjf.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. At wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is the sound of distant drums.
The crisis in the Middle East, fueled by Iran's nuclear ambitions, continues to escalate tonight.
There's a growing possibility of an attack by Iran on American soil, hence the circling of the wagons, essentially.
So what will ultimately work in stopping Iran's nuclear program? Sanctions or bombs or something else?
The prospect of attacking Iran has become a point of honor on the presidential campaign trail for nearly every GOP candidate.
This is a president who should have instead communicated to Iran that we are prepared, that we are considering military options. They're not just on the table, they are in our hand.
Two or three nuclear weapons wipes out most of the Jews who live in Israel. I believe Ahmadinejad would do it in a heartbeat.
And I would be saying to the Iranians, you either open up those facilities, you begin to dismantle them and make them available to inspectors, or we will degrade those facilities through airstrikes.
I said nearly every candidate. There's always Ron Paul.
I think that would be the most foolish thing in the world to do right now is take on Iran.
This week, Iran reacted to the sound of American drums by warning it could launch preemptive action against its enemies to ensure its own security. Meanwhile, a recent Pew Research Center poll finds that 58% of Americans say it's important to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, even if it means taking military action, versus just 30% who say it's more important to avoid military conflict with Iran. The majority sentiment, however, is not shared by national security experts. Here's Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, on CNN earlier this week.
We are of the opinion that the Iranian regime is a rational actor. And it's for that reason, I think, that we think the current path we're on is the most prudent path at this point.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. He wrote this week that it's a little puzzling that Americans should talk about another war, especially after the recent dispiriting experience of protracted war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Micah Zenko, who studies conflict at the Council on Foreign Relations, said that the next war always looks a lot more promising than the last war. That when you're faced with a complex foreign policy challenge that goes on for a while, there's an urge to do something, and nothing does something like military action.
Which I guess explains why, with the exception of Ron Paul, the Republican presidential candidates are competing to show how tough they would be on Iran.
That's right. I remember in one debate, Rick Perry actually upped the ante by saying he would actually favor reinvading Iraq.
And yet, the national security experts say that an attack on Iran is not only irrational, it actually would endanger our security.
There is a theory that holds a lot of sway in the U.S. government, and I think with some Israelis, that ironically, a strike against the Iranian nuclear program might be the quickest route to Iran having a nuclear weapon, because that would convince the regime that it needed a weapon to survive and that it would hunker down and build a nuclear weapon as soon as it possibly could.
So why this disconnect between the politicians and the national security experts who have all the inside dope?
There does seem to me to be quite a striking gap. In fact, that was on display at a couple of recent hearings in which members of Congress were pressing intelligence officials. The members of Congress were mostly saying, come on, come on, you know Iran has decided to go for a nuclear weapon. And the officials, notably Jim Clapper, the director of national intelligence, was pushing back and saying no, that intelligence agencies do not believe Iran has made a decision yet.
In your article, you said that echoes of the period leading up to the Iraq War in 2003 are unmistakable.
We in the media report a lot of somewhat loose statements that imply that Iran is close to a weapon, that Iran wants to make a weapon.
What loose statements? Who's making them?
Well, we are.
Uh-huh. How are they attributed to senior administration officials?
Well, I think sometimes it's actually just our summaries of what's going on. Do you say that Iran is believed to be working toward making a weapon? Sometimes we use these wiggle words, which no one really knows what they mean, working towards a nuclear capability. It is difficult to describe because on the one hand, you have Iran pouring huge resources into a secret program to enrich uranium. On the other hand, you have fairly clear statements from American intelligence officials saying they have not yet decided to make a weapon. So how do you characterize that? And I think the analogy with 2002, 2003 is that there were varying descriptions of what weapons of mass destruction Saddam Hussein might have, what he might be buying, and what it would mean. Aluminum tubes come to mind. Our newspaper, the New York Times, among others, got into some trouble by overstating the evidence for Saddam's weapons, which of course famously turned out not to exist. And so here at the New York Times, we've had a number of discussions about how do we phrase this stuff. Our public editor wrote a blog item sort of slapping us on the wrist for one story that he thought had gone a little bit too far.
The ombudsman of the Washington Post did much the same at that paper, slaps on the wrist. But of course, there are big differences between now and 2003. As you note in your article, you don't have an administration hell-bent for war as you did in the Bush administration. Are the same people fueling the pundits and the debates right now?
Probably the group who then were very much in favor of taking on Saddam Hussein would tend to be hawkish on Iran. But I don't think the impetus is really coming from there. I think part of it's coming from Israel in the form of predictions or threats that Israel will mount a strike.
Israel, certainly, but no less, surely, this political season and the endless series of debates where Iran is the looming issue that Republicans have turned into a point of distinction between themselves and the administration.
Absolutely. I mean, Iran has an election coming up very soon, and then we're obviously in the middle of a long election season. Historians of war say that this is a dangerous period where you have a lot of rhetoric being thrown around for domestic consumption as much as for international consumption. And there's always the possibility of a series of missteps that leads to a war that no one particularly wants.
So what is the responsibility of the news media when confronting a season as dangerous as this?
Our obligation is to be precise and careful, try to represent a range of points of view. We do have a policy here to say in every story that Iran claims it is not trying to build a weapon.
But there's a way to say that, which just...
is dismissive.
Right.
Yeah. And it's probably more credible to say U.S. intelligence officials say that they do not believe Iran has made a decision to build a weapon. And to do our own reporting, a colleague of mine, Elizabeth Buehmiller, wrote a very interesting story talking about how many American military experts, including a lot at the Pentagon, do not actually believe Israel has the capacity to mount a strike that can set back Iran's nuclear program. Most of us had been writing, you know, will Israel strike or will they not strike? And the assumption was that Israel certainly had the capability of striking. This raised serious questions about that. But I think another assumption that gets buried into the reporting is the idea that there's a sort of binary choice here. You don't do anything and Iran gets a weapon, or you strike against them and keep Iran from getting a weapon. It is much more complicated than the sort of black and white way that we tend to portray it.
You know, there was a really interesting study that was done after the first Iraq war. The question asked was, how much do you understand the background of the war, the context, what's the argument about? The more people watched television, the less they understood about Iraq. And I just wonder if the same goes for the political debates and Iran.
Well, I do think that the political process tends to boil everything down to very simple choices. Mitt Romney has said on the campaign trail, elect me and Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. Re-elect President Obama and Iran will get a nuclear weapon. So that's just the nature of politics. Unfortunately, that does not always fit the subtleties and contradictions that are inherent in a problem as complex as the question of Iran's nuclear program.
Not always, huh, Scott?
Not always.
Not ever.
Not ever.
Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. On Saturday evening, the Academy Awards will honor the best acting and filmmaking of the year, at least Hollywood's consensus on the best. One category that will be conspicuous by its absence, at least according to Bob, is the best dramatization of a newscast, because most years there would be no plausible nominees. Here he is to complain more about his pet peeve.
You know what Hollywood is really good at faking? Gunshot wounds. Also, ocean liner sinkings. D-Day landings. Car chases. And even ill-fated moon voyages.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem.
They can do train wrecks and surgery and ballet, bank jobs and death camps and Spider-Men. But damn if they can get the evening news.
Whether suicide or homicide, the sport and the city lost a well-loved and once revered hero.
This is Media Break. You give us 3 minutes, and we'll give you the world.
Good morning. I'm Casey Wong with Jess Perkins. Top story, Pretoria. The threat of nuclear confrontation in South Africa escalated.
Related news, an attempted robbery turned tragic today when the owner of a local pawn shop opened fire on an intruder. The armed robber was pronounced dead at the scene. He has been identified as...
That last clip was from Drive with Ryan Gosling, who stares and mumbles and drives fast fairly convincingly, but when he takes refuge in a diner after a pawn shop heist, verisimilitude runs off the rails. When it comes to faithfully depicting the look and feel of a newscast, Hollywood nearly always can't. I asked New York Magazine film critic David Edelstein if, for instance, movies and TV shows ever get the style of news copy right.
No.
Do they get the cadence right?
Never.
Do they get the set design right?
20 years ago, right.
Lighting?
No.
Hair? Wardrobe? Anything?
No. The people who write these movies know nothing about how information is dispensed on television. All they want to know is what the dramatic beats, what they have to get across in the scene, what their protagonist or antagonist has to hear, the information that the audience has to know. They don't actually care about anything else. They don't care enough even to learn it, and it can be learned in a couple of minutes.
It's not just that movies and TV shows get it wrong. They get it wrong in so many ways. Take, for instance, the courthouse steps trope, in which a reporter manages to snag a dramatic soundbite live on the scene, such as in this episode of Law and Order SVU.
Ms. Bond! Ms. Bond! Make a comment! You have a statement, Ms. Bond!
No comment!
Ms. Bond, what do you have to say to Lindsay?
No comment!
Are the mushrooms from Krochik's lab? What is the defendant's connection to the victim?
Why don't you ask the defendant? Hint, it's about water.
As Fred D'Ambrosi, news director at WUSA in Washington, D.C., points out, almost all live shots are extremely brief reporter stand-ups introducing packages that have been taped and edited earlier.
You know, we always shoot stuff in advance and then repackage it. Even in Morning Glory, when Harrison Ford rolls up in front of the governor's house, they've got 500 people in the control room, but like one guy with a live truck, no live truck operator, just him and the photographer, and somehow they're magically live. The governor like comes to the door.
Pomeroy. Gary, how are you?
What the hell are you doing here?
Weather vanes.
Specifically, yes. Governor, we'd like to know how you feel about the Attorney General's filing racketeering charges against you this morning, charges of corruption, money laundering, steering government contracts.
Wait.
We cannot wait. That's pretty cool. And I'd like to do that story sometime.
Yeah, Fred, not likely. Morning Glory falls in the subcategory of Hollywood movies about TV news. Harrison Ford plays a hard-bitten network anchor, suddenly miscast as a morning show host. He plays opposite co-anchor Diane Keaton, who, I must say, nails her character cold.
Coming up next, you've heard her sing. Well, today, you're going to hear about her sweet tooth. Join us as we bake brownies with Celine Dion's personal chef. All that and more coming up on Daybreak.
We did a kind of boot camp with Harrison and with Diane.
Morning Glory director Roger Michel.
We took them to sort of school for presenters. They learned how to read a teleprompter, how to change cameras, the basic grammar that we take for granted about news presenters. Diane particularly loved it and responded to it and loved kind of peering behind the facade.
Ford, whose character is supposed to exude mega gravitas, was not so quick a study.
Federal authorities have been planning this raid for weeks. This reporter has learned that the indictment contains 15 counts of racketeering and using undue influence. Mike Pomeroy, Daybreak.
Back to you in the studio.
While Michelle does not believe, as I do, that Ford sounded less like a news anchor than a random stroke victim, the director does allow that mimicking TV news's natural unnaturalness is no easy trick.
You know, it is very, very hard to pitch it correctly, to get it absolutely right. There are lots of tells, aren't there?
That's what Brian Spicer says, too. He's the inveterate TV director who's worked on such series as Terra Nova, V, Burn Notice, Castle, CSI, and 24. For Spicer, one big problem is that newscasts use newscasts for relaying information, and dramas use newscasts for drama.
I mean, people are more interested in seeing drama on television than they are being told what the story is. They'd rather see what the story is and see it unfold through drama rather than exposition.
The other big problem, he says, is logistical.
Sometimes I think under the work schedule that we have, every script starts off with exposition, and it's up to the writers and directors to turn the exposition into drama, and sometimes they run out of time. You know, they're backed up on delivery dates and writing, and sometimes we can't always get the script the way we want it before it comes out.
And yet, despite all the logistics and so forth, one show does manage to fake TV news with uncanny precision every broadcast. That would be The Onion News Network.
And in a surprise announcement this morning, U.S. Deputy Surgeon General Greg Paulson stated that, quote, it's fine to smoke cigarettes if you only smoke while drinking. The Deputy Surgeon General has called a press conference to...
Carol Kolb, head writer for the TV Onion, says Hollywood's problem is...
I think maybe someone just isn't studying it enough. One thing is just use real newscasters. Go to the people that actually do it. It will sound realer. Another thing is just sort of camera angles or the cuts. Think about what type of news story you're actually doing. If it's a breaking news piece or maybe if it's a news magazine piece, they all have a different feel. And just sort of think about these things when you're filming your million-dollar movie.
Million-dollar?
Billion-dollar. Billion-dollar.
Well, anyway, 70 million, such as Battle Los Angeles, which features a particularly unlikely live remote from Santa Monica Beach. In the midst of the most realistic alien invasion ever.
Coming up, in pursuit of better art, is it okay to fake the truth? For instance, monkey brains. They're really hard to fake, but it's totally worth it.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Writer John DeGatto was volunteering at a suicide helpline in Las Vegas when a teenager named Levi Presley jumped to his death from the roof of the Stratosphere Hotel on July 13, 2002. DeGatto became convinced that he'd talked to Presley before his death. Turned out he hadn't, but it did prompt him to explore the question of why Presley took his life and why Las Vegas has the nation's highest suicide rate. The Believer magazine offered to publish DeGatto's piece, despite his warning that the essay, more of a meditation really, wasn't altogether factual. No problem. The Believer assigned John DeGatto fact-checker Jim Fingal. And what began as an argument between them over nitpicking became an epic debate over authorial codes of conduct and perhaps even the nature of truth. A version of that dialogue has been assembled and superimposed on DeGatto's original article in the new book called The Lifespan of a Fact. The exchange you're about to hear is sparked after some wrangling over the accuracy of a quote when fact-checker Jim Fingal writes this note to self.
In other words, he's manipulating what this guy actually said in order to create a literary effect, which apparently is allowed among writers of John's non-journalistic literary genre, for which he apparently writes all the rules.
I'm not sure how I can say this so that you understand, Jim, because it doesn't seem to be getting across to you. But one more time for the record, I am not a journalist. I'm an essayist. And this is a genre that has existed for a few thousand years. Ever heard of Cicero? So these rules that I'm working under are not mine, but rather were established by writers who recognized the difference between the hard research of journalism and the kind of inquiry of mind that characterizes the essay.
Basically, it sounds like you're saying that an essayist can write things with arbitrary truth value and make quotations up out of whole cloth that are attributed to real people who live in the real world. Is that right? And if so, isn't that what people call fiction?
Have I changed the meaning of anything here, Jim? No, I've just streamlined this quote in order to help things move along a little better and to create a bit of resonance with neighboring paragraphs. It's what writers do.
Okay, so now I understand. The rules are, there are no rules, just as long as you make it pretty.
That's a bullshit interpretation of what I just said.
I thought you were the great defender of people's right to interpret.
Jim, you seem to have two classes of facts that you're checking. One is simple information, as in how many seconds did it take for Levi Presley to hit the ground? John says 9 seconds. You found out it was 8 seconds. What made that 1 second so important?
It's the job of the editor or whoever is going to publish this to determine what are the tolerance levels for fudging or streamlining. The fact checker's job is to call out even the most insignificant things as incorrect if indeed that's what they are.
John?
The idea that Levi's body had taken 9 seconds to fall from the top of the tower was actually something I received from his parents. Long before I had gained access to the coroner's report, which revealed that it was 8 seconds. And so I started researching what 9 means in our culture and in cultures across the world. And so by the time I met the coroner and found out that I was off by a second, the essay had already started structuring itself around 9. Within the essay itself, I actually acknowledge that I got that wrong. And after that moment, the essay, at least I intend for it to fall out of that journalistic mode. And it's signaled by a pretty loud quote from T.S. Eliot, which is that sometimes we misplace knowledge in pursuit of information.
The knowledge resided more in the number 9. Possession is 9/10 of the law. To look 9 ways is to squint. To be dressed to the 9s is to be looking great. To be on cloud 9 is to be feeling high. All these citations of the word 9, they resonated. To remove them would sacrifice knowledge for information. Jim, did you buy that?
You know, the fact checker is not allowed to buy those arguments in terms of what they're doing, and that's what causes the descent into madness.
If you were to have called this an impressionistic essay based on a real event, would that have eliminated the need for a fact checker at all? Is this a problem fundamentally of categories?
It is a problem of categories. When I pick up a medical history, I, at least as a reader, don't expect to have the same experience in that text as I would in someone's memoir. I'm looking for an emotional experience in that memoir, and I really don't care whether that writer needs to change the kind of pie that Aunt B was really well known for from apple to rhubarb, because rhubarb is going to provide me with a fantastic, resonant emotional experience a few pages into the book. I want that experience.
Okay, so you two eventually have a battle royale. And John, you give a stem-winding summation of your philosophy on page 108.
Those who embrace the idea of nonfiction are very welcome to it, and I wish them every joy in the world in that pursuit, genuinely. But please don't hold me to parameters for making essays that I wholly disagree with and that I believe misrepresent the true purpose of this genre. An essay is an attempt, Jim, nothing else. And fundamentally, for centuries, that's all it's been. Even etymologically, essay means an attempt. And so as a writer of essays, my interpretation of that charge is that I try to take control of something before it is lost entirely to chaos. That's what I want to be held accountable for as a writer. It's how I want to be judged.
I don't necessarily believe that a nonfiction essay has to strive for an objective account of an occurrence as its primary project, or that the writer is ethically obligated to secure the reality of an event in cultural memory. And I'm all for the POMO, historiographic, metafictional appropriation of events and personages. But there still seems to be something strange about doing this sort of thing with someone like Levi, who is just a teenager, after all. Just a kid in Las Vegas. Not a cultural figure or an icon whose life is for the taking and can be radically manipulated and reinterpreted. I mean, clearly, it's not like you're defiling his grave by propagating these inaccuracies, but it's kind of like you're being dishonest about where that grave is.
During the process, at any point, John, were you seeking the approval of Jim?
You know, I've never told Jim this, but, you know, I secretly think that Jim is about 25 feet smarter than I am. So once we got into this project and started debating, I did want to win, but by win I meant I wanted to try to persuade him, because I figured if I could do that, I might actually be right if someone like Jim could be turned.
To the degree that I wanted to convert John, it was trying to get an agreement on the point of the reader who comes across a text like this and whether or not anyone explicitly leads them to believe it's entirely factual. The way that they're affected by it relies on some sense of authenticity, that something actually happened, and maybe if they see a little bit of themselves in it, they feel a little bit less alone. They perhaps feel more alone when they find out that it was made up or elaborated or streamlined, and maybe there isn't actually someone in the world that's like that.
And yet, in your final concluding note to self, you concede that the truth of anything is a very slippery commodity. Maybe the parents don't remember, maybe the coroner's report is wrong. And you say, which of these sources can we trust as the authority if they've all demonstrated in one way or another the potential of inaccurately representing what actually happened that night? And could you pick it up from there?
Does it even matter? I mean, even if everything that's in question could be verified by unbiased third-party witnesses, and even if I could definitively determine to a fraction of a second exactly when it was that Levi left his house, when he dove off the tower at 6:01 p.m. and 53 seconds and plummeted for a total of 8 seconds onto a sidewalk of brown brick herringbone, well then, I don't know. I'd have done my job. But wouldn't he still be dead?
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Fingal is a software designer. John, thank you too.
Thank you.
John DeGatta teaches creative writing at the University of Iowa. Their book is called The Lifespan of a Fact. And now, a look back on another case of truth redefined by the artist, a tale from the crypt, so to speak, 1978's stomach-churning cult film, Faces of Death. Faces of Death combined genuine images of blood and guts with faked footage when the real stuff wasn't available. It's schlocky, gruesome, spasmodically compelling, and anchored by the film's supposed creator, the fictional pathologist, Dr. Francis Gross.
Prepare yourself for a journey into a world where each new step may give you a better understanding of your own reality. For I am sure you will gain a new perspective from the many faces of death.
Made on a modest budget of around $450,000, the film went on to make upwards of $35 million, spawn several sequels, and become enshrined in the pantheon of American cult film. This month, a piece in Deadspin offered a guide to what was real and what wasn't in Faces of Death, which brought back the primal experience of watching it to OTM producer Alex Goldman, who suggested this segment.
My first experience of Faces of Death was a sadistic older brother who decided to put me in front of the TV and show me the movie, which burned some pretty specific images indelibly into my mind.
Like what?
The scene where a group of people eat the brains of a monkey and a scene in which a man is executed in the electric chair. It was only after we'd watched the movie that my brother told me that all the footage was real.
Okay. You may go, Alex.
All right. I'm out of here.
Now I'm going to bring in the creator of Faces of Death, John Alan Schwartz. You just heard Alex. Does that sound like a familiar scenario?
Yeah, because each new generation discovers it. And even though things look hokey now, there are still segments that people actually believe are real that aren't.
And the two that Alex happened to mention, the eating of the monkey brains after clubbing the monkey to death at a restaurant, and the man in the electric chair, those are both faked scenes, right?
They are. And the thing that made the monkey so incredible is that we found a monkey trainer. And so what we did is we built a special table and rented a Moroccan restaurant and put some friends of ours around the table.
As the monkey was brought down the hall and a toast to prosperity was made, the waiter presented the men with their tools of destruction.
When we put the monkey into the table and he began to get struck by the mallets, which of course were made of foam, the monkey went crazy. In the interim, our makeup department had cast the head of the monkey weeks earlier, so that as the camera's cutting away and they're supposedly killing this monkey, we switched the real monkey with the prosthetic monkey. The monkey brains was cauliflower and theater blood.
Mm-hmm. Now we know the who, what, where, and how, but we still don't know why.
Why not? Basically, the Japanese came to this small family film company and said to us, we want to make a movie about death. It was a chance to have complete creative control. And what young, aspiring filmmaker wouldn't want to do that? They gave us the money and we put it all together and never had anybody to answer to but ourselves.
How does this low-budget blood fest bound for Japan become an American cult classic?
There were some various independent distributors that saw the film and then brought it to America. And one night I was working at my typist house and Dan Rather was the anchor for CBS News. And Dan Rather said, there's a movie out called Faces of Death. that should never have seen the light of day, and I figured I'd never work in Hollywood again. But it actually had the opposite effect.
You played a character in the film, another made-up scene of a satanic, flesh-eating cult?
On the outskirts of San Francisco, a cult existed that promised its members immortality. I had heard rumors about their ceremony. They believed that the power of everlasting life was found in the internal organs of the dead.
I actually appeared in the first three. In the first one, I was the head of a satanic cult where we eat the body. In Faces of Death 2, I was a drug addict. And then for my third thing, I was a rapist.
Contrary to predictions, the movie didn't kill your work in Hollywood, right? And the people who hire you know about Faces of Death, presumably.
Yeah.
Have you ever worked with anybody who said it directly affected their work?
Yeah, it's a director who was doing a television show, and we had a thing about a camera moving back and forth. In real time, it showed a guy trying to break into a car repair shop, and the dogs wind up attacking him. And the camera goes from the dogs attacking him because the camera's moving back and forth.
Is your dog attacking you right now?
No, my dog's protecting me.
Go ahead.
But anyway, he utilized that whole concept of the moving camera and did a reality series, which I can't remember the name of it now, but he came and thanked me.
How do you feel about it when you see it? I mean, it's really gross.
I have to tell you, seeing it was nothing compared to filming it and being there, you know? When you enter the county morgue, you walk down the hallway. Anybody who dies an unnatural death is sent to the morgue. So you see people who have hung themselves or twisted from a car accident, suicide, gunshots. And then finally, as we're walking down the hall and there are all these dead people on this gurney waiting to get processed, the doors open like you enter a supermarket. But instead, we entered a room where seven autopsies were going on simultaneously. And it smelled like a bad deli, and the lunchroom was right around the corner. And then one of the guys says, I hope you're going to stay for lunch. And that was like truly one of the only times in my life that I really lost my appetite.
Do you think that this movie still has the power to shock when anyone can find similar images with just a Google search?
Well, you know the old saying, often imitated but never duplicated?
You can get gore, but you're not going to get this gore.
The thing is that the film can be seen on so many different emotional levels. I'll never forget, when we finished the cut of the movie, we rented the little theater on the Fox lot, and we had like 500 people come see the movie. And at the end of the movie, there was like silence in the theater. And at the time, I was dating a woman whose father was an anesthesiologist. And he came up to me and said it was the most comprehensive film he'd ever seen on death in his life, and that he thought it was great that the public are finally going to get informed about an area that's so taboo in our society.
And it didn't bother him that so much of it was fake?
I don't think it even came on his registration scale that it was or wasn't.
And you didn't have any particular problem with it?
Particular problem with what?
You're presenting it as a documentary. You used fake footage of cruelty and inhumane practices like killing people in an electric chair. Did you ever feel like you were just being exploitative, that you were being prurient?
I don't think we were looking at ourselves with that kind of magnifying glass. I think instead we had the magnifying glass on the subject matter at hand.
Right. And when you're dealing with real life subjects, even the electric chair, I could see that. But things like flesh-eating cults or eating monkey brains, haven't you gone maybe a bridge too far?
No, because they're plausible realities. This is true. Who's to say there's not a flesh-eating cult out there right now? I mean, anything's possible. And as far as the monkey brains is concerned, there are people that have bizarre tastes and will eat anything.
So why not monkey brains?
That's exactly right.
That's a very interesting way to look at it.
By taking it seriously, by saying, okay, I'm going to convince you that people eat monkey brains. Yes, it's our scenario, but it's just a copy of a scenario that actually exists somewhere around the world.
Maybe, right?
Maybe not, maybe. I think we're closer to possibly more than maybe.
Okay, John, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
John Alan Schwartz is a filmmaker and creator of Faces of Death. He and his wife Joan have an online series of movie reviews called Two Jews on Film, which can be found at twojewsonfilm.com.
That's it for this week's show on the media. It was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.